Hello and welcome to today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers. What makes successful authors tick? What does it take to sell that manuscript? Is self-publishing a good option? Or is selling your book to a big publishing house still the only way to fly? What about keeping up with your first big success? We'll talk about all this and more on today's show, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Hello and welcome to Authors Between the Covers. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, your host. We are here today with Uber award-winning celebrity children's book author Kate DiCamillo. You probably know her name, but you most definitely know the stories that she's written that star some of literature's most beloved anthropomorphic characters. In her vessel of books is Because of Winn-Dixie, The Tale of Despero, and her most recent Flora and Ulysses. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Thank you. What a wonderful introduction.
So what I want to do before we launch in is tell our audience a little bit about you and a little bit about this wonderful book, which I actually had the privilege of writing about for Costco's magazine, The Costco Connection. So let's jump into this. You know, it's no surprise that Flora and Ulysses won the 2014 Newbery Medal. It's an honor that you have added to your collection that includes the National Book Award in 2001, the Boston Globe Horn Book Award in 2006, and the Theodore Geisel Award in 2007 and 2011. But this book is so enchanting and touching, like all of your books are. So here's a little taste of Flora and Ulysses. Flora Bell Buckman is 10 and hates romance. She prides herself on being a natural-born cynic, and while she wants to believe in superheroes, she just can't make herself buy into the premise. At least, that's how she feels during the summer after fifth grade when she's reading The Illuminated Adventures of the Amazing Incandesto. But with the whoosh of a vacuum cleaner, all that changes. As Flora looks out her bedroom window, she observes Mrs. Tickman, her neighbor, using her vacuum cleaner, the Ulysses Super Suction Multi-Terrain 2000X, on her lawn, and she sucks up an unassuming squirrel. It's an incident that magically gives him superpowers. "Holy gabunga," shouts Flora, witnessing the scene from the window. Holy gabunga indeed. So Kate, tell us, what inspired you to write Flora and Ulysses?
Wow, I'm listening to all of that and thinking, what an odd book, right? It vacuums up a squirrel. Squirrel becomes a superhero. For me, it started with two entirely separate things. One was my mother had passed away, and she had an Electrolux vacuum cleaner that she loved a lot. And she was always worried about what was going to happen to it after she was gone. And I took the vacuum cleaner, as I kept on assuring her that I would. I had it in my garage because she had a cat. I'm allergic to cats. So I kept on thinking I need to, like, you know, decat it and then I'll bring it in. And every time I pulled into the garage, I would see the vacuum cleaner. It would make me sad and it would make me miss my mother. So that's one thing, the vacuum cleaner. And then the other totally separate thing is the squirrel. The spring after my mom died, there was a squirrel on my front steps who was obviously in a great deal of distress, and he looked like he was dying, and I didn't know what to do for him. And I called one of my best friends who lives a block and a half away, and I said, "There's a squirrel who's dying on my front steps. What should I do?" And she said, "Do you have a shovel?" I'm like, "Yeah, I've got a shovel." And she said, "Get the shovel, get a T-shirt, I'll come over there and I'll whack him over the head," which was a horrifying idea. And so I, like, backed up away from the squirrel, and the squirrel left at that point. So now I've got a squirrel, I've got a vacuum cleaner, and I start to think about ways to save a squirrel's life, and this is what you get.
Wow. That's amazing.
Right? There's no explaining it, but that's the best I can do.
So with all of your books, they involve these wonderful, magical creatures, animals. Why do animals play such a significant role in your books?
You know, I don't know, and you know, kids ask that all the time, and I don't really have an answer. I love animals. For a long time, I thought I wanted to be a veterinarian when I was a kid, and I don't sit down purposely thinking I'm going to put an animal in the story, but they keep on showing up. I do think that as readers, we're a little bit more inclined to open our heart to an animal protagonist, we're a little bit more likely to trust. And so I don't do it on purpose, but I do think it's a good way to pull a reader in.
Oh, absolutely. Well, clearly, most people think so. Your 12 New York Times bestselling titles have sold 20.5 million copies and been translated into 39 languages. So you're definitely onto something.
Wow. Again, I'm like, wow, that's intimidating, all of that. Let's not think about it.
You know, I find this actually charming and enchanting about you. You told me earlier when we were first talking that you're stunned that any of your books have made it into print. Why is that? And what's the backstory on that?
Well, I think that, you know, and of course, you know, when you put that statement up against all those statistics that you just said, it sounds like I'm being disingenuous. But it's this thing where I was a late bloomer. I was a person who for a long time, all through my 20s, wanted to be a writer and talked about being a writer and dreamed about being a writer and told people that I was a writer and didn't actually write anything. And it wasn't until I was almost 30 years old that I thought, man, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to write something. So I started late, and it took me, you know, a lot of rejection letters and a long time to get published. And so I just think I'm hyper aware always that it could have gone very differently. I feel really blessed that I got published. I think that I could have frittered away the rest of my life talking about doing it. That's one thing that could have happened. I think that I could have spent much longer receiving rejection letters. I'm always very, very aware of how it could have gone differently. So I'm just thrilled to be here.
Well, we're thrilled that you pushed forward with it. And I think that happens to a lot of people. There's a part of you that knows that you're supposed to do something. It's just hard to kind of get out of the gate with it.
Right. And I think that, you know, what I always say to kids is, and they're not necessarily thrilled with this piece of advice, but for me, it's what worked. It was like, it's actually easier to do the work than it is to not do the work. So to like have a dream and not do the work for it is harder than actually sitting down and doing the work. And so that's still the maxim that I operate by. When I get up in the morning, I do 2 pages before I do anything else, because I know I'll never want to do it, but I'm always happier once I've done it.
Kind of like exercising.
Yes, very much so.
Well, and I think that's true. You know, it's about fear, too. It's much easier to be afraid of something than to just, you know, embrace your fear and move forward. So I think it has to do, you know, not just with writing, right?
Right. No, but it's interesting to me that we're all much more comfortable being afraid and not acting. And it's exhausting to be in that place.
Right.
And so it's actually more exhilarating to be afraid all the time, which is where I am as a writer, but to do the work, you know.
Talk a little bit about that. You're always afraid as a writer, because I feel that way too, but I just push through it. So how do you feel when you sit down to write something?
I have the same general thoughts going through my head all the time. I don't know what I'm doing. I can't imagine that I'll ever find my way through this. And then, you know, there's also a voice that says, who do you think you are? You're not a writer. And I have a couple of tricks for dealing with those voices. One is that for me, that all those negative thoughts tend to come after 9 o'clock. So that critic that lives in me is a lot more subdued earlier in the morning. So I get up early and I write before all those voices can take over. And then the other thing that I found is what works for me is to move slowly, just a little bit each day. Although you would think that would get you nowhere. 2 pages a day isn't very much. But to take those small steps every day adds up to, you know, a novel in a year's time if you show up all the time.
What are you working on now?
I just finished a novel. And, you know, to say finished is, of course, completely erroneous, because now there will be editorial letters, you know, that so I'll have to rewrite it a couple more times. I'm hoping for a couple. It might be more than that. So, but I took it as far as I could on my own, and now my editor will help me, even though I will resent her until we're done.
I think that's something that most people don't realize. They think an author maybe sits down and comes up with a finished masterpiece, you know, within a short period of time. But that's actually not the process, is it?
No, it's not. You know, there's a wonderful book called Art and Fear, and they talk in there about how there's one Mozart born every century, somebody who hears the music and puts it down on the paper, a genius like that. And then they say, guess what? That's not you. If you want to make some kind of art, you have to be willing to make mistakes and have it and work it and rework it and rework it and rework it. I think that a lot of people, I know people who have thought that they wanted to write their whole lives, and they'll sit down and they'll try to do it, and they'll find how it doesn't come out right, and they think, I'm not supposed to be a writer. But I think we just have this problem thinking that if you're supposed to do it, it's going to come out right the first time, and it doesn't.
Yeah, we were talking, we interviewed Ridley Pearson, who was our cover story a few years ago, and he was saying he writes his books at least six times. He and Dave Barry wrote Peter and the Starcatchers, which became a Broadway show.
Six times sounds low to me. Well, no, I come in at about eight or nine. So I'm usually at about six times by the time I turn it into my editor. And then I'll go two to three more rounds with her. So yeah, I'm about the same. But we all exist in that fantasy that somewhere somebody is doing it without having to struggle that way. And I don't know those people. I know a lot of writers. I don't know anybody that doesn't struggle.
Yes, exactly. So take us back in time a little bit. So how did you support yourself when you were saying you wanted to be a writer but weren't making a living at it?
Oh, you know, I was in Florida at the time, so I worked at Disney World for a good portion of my youth and Epcot Center. I wore a blue polyester space suit, and I told people to watch their step. That was one job. I worked at Circus World. I worked in a greenhouse. I worked at a campground calling bingo, that kind of stuff. And then I moved here to Minneapolis when I was 30 years old. And it was just around the time that I had started to write. And I got a job here in a book warehouse. And I was assigned to the third floor, which was all children's books. And that was one of the happiest things that could have happened to me, because I started reading all of those books. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to write for kids.
Wow. So do you think it's fate? Like, you knew that what you were supposed to be doing, and it just didn't arrive in time, you know, for you to be doing it in your 20s, and it had to evolve? Or if you had taken a different path, your life would have turned out differently?
I don't, it's a question that is terrifying to consider, you know, because I look back now, and I mean, I have enough perspective at 50 to say, what if I'd moved here and I hadn't gotten a job at the book warehouse and I hadn't been assigned to the third floor? You know, I each little thing seems to add up to something that, and people will say to me, aren't you mad at yourself for wasting your 20s and not writing then? And I'm not, because to wish it any different would mean that it would be a different story in the end. And I feel so fortunate about where I ended up and how it played out, you know?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That is so exciting. And in fact, two of your books have been turned into movies because of Winn-Dixie and The Tale of Despero. What was that process like, going from printed copies to motion picture?
Well, it's kind of surreal because, I mean, you're alone in your little room in the dark and the wee hours of the morning writing. It's strange enough for those writings to turn into a book. But then to have them up there on a gigantic screen, you know, what was in your head is now up on a screen. It's unbelievable. And it's fantastic too, because movies bring so many people back to the book, you know. So it's a whole new group of people will discover the book. So it's been a fabulous thing.
Wow, what a great cycle that is. Now, tell us a little bit more about Flora, because, you know, you have to love Flora and Ulysses, of course. And this book is so funny. And the illustrations by Keith Gordon Campbell are amazing. In fact, he's going to be our Fine Artist of the Month in the September issue of Being Candescent magazine, September 2014, where you will be our cover girl. So we are thrilled to have that happen. So take us, so Flora's 10. Did something life-changing happen when you were about 10?
No, you know, but it's interesting because that's where I almost always go back to with stories. I seem to be stuck at 10, and I don't know why. You know, my parents, like Flora's parents, were separated, and so I grew up in a single-parent home. So that certainly is, you know, reflective of me. And there's always that – it's funny because when this book came out, my friends were – so taken with the notion that I was Flora, and it's like I don't recognize myself there, but they see me there. And I was saying this to my editor, and I said, all of my friends are like, wow, that's you on the page. And she's like, wow, that's really interesting. I always thought that you were the squirrel. And I do have a lot of the squirrel like tendencies. I'm always hungry. I'm always talking about what's to eat next. I love poetry. You know, but that Flora is in many respects me, and I bow to these people who know me better than I know myself. So
that's fun. That's great. And how about Tale of Winn-Dixie?
Winn-Dixie was the first thing that I published, and it was written pretty soon after I moved to Minnesota. And it was one of the worst winters on record. So it was a book about wanting to go, you know, back to Florida, and also a book about wanting to have a dog and not being able to have one. And both of those longings ended up in that book, you know, a dog and home and being in a new place.
Mm, fabulous. And so it was because of Winn-Dixie. So why Winn-Dixie?
Why the name Winn-Dixie? When the book came out here, people were like, Winn-Dixie, what's that? I mean, it was just like absolutely foreign to them. But, you know, I grew up where there was a Winn-Dixie in every little town. So the big grocery store chain in the South. And there was a Winn-Dixie a couple blocks away from the house that I grew up in. So it was just very much a word that conjured where I had come from, you know.
Yep, because of, yes, and I lived in Miami too, so I knew the Winn-Dixie. But
people will come through and bring a picture of a Winn-Dixie sign or them standing in front of a Winn-Dixie store, and they're like, look at this. And it's like, yep. But people can't believe they're real if they haven't heard of them, yeah.
Are they still around, do you know?
They are still around.
That's great. They must have got a bump in sales too because of it. And how about the Tale of Despero? Tell us a little bit about that.
Despero was my best friend's son, who's now grown up and married and working on a novel himself. He was 8 years old when Winn-Dixie came out, and he was always a big reader. And I was visiting them, and he was suddenly very impressed with me in a way that he hadn't been before, because my name was on the cover of this book. And towards the end of the visit, he took me into his room for a private conversation. And he said, I've got a great idea for a book. And I said, what is it? He said, it's the story of an unlikely hero with exceptionally large ears. I'm like, wow, what happens to the hero? And he said, I don't know. That's why I want you to write the book. So that's where I started, was with big ears and an unlikely hero. And by the time the book was out in the world, he was almost 13, and he came to the Newbery banquet, and I made him stand up, and he was very embarrassed.
But you launched his career.
He can write. He can really write. It'll be interesting to see what he does.
That is so cool. And in fact, you are the 2014-2015 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Tell us what that means.
That means that I have the wonderful job of going around and reminding people about the power of stories and how reading together connects us. It's a message that I am thrilled to carry out into the world and one I believe in absolutely. So it's just kind of a reminder about the joy and power of reading. That's what I'm going to talk about for the next year and a half.
That's great. So do you travel around the country doing that?
Yeah, we've got, I think, 4 events left this year. And then we've got all of next year mapped out. So it's basically like every other month I'll go out and visit some place that I haven't been before usually.
And we can follow you on Facebook?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we'll put that link in, and we will make sure that our readers and our listeners know how to get in front of, in an audience where you might be speaking. Before we let you go, though, can you give us some advice to kids who are trying to work things out and how they might be able to use your stories to do that?
Absolutely. Well, I have the same advice for kids that I do for adults, and adults often will ask on the basis of getting advice for the kids, but they really, a lot of adults still have that dream inside them too to become a writer. So I almost always say the same thing, which is the most important thing that you can do, adult or child, if you want to write, is to read as much as you can and in as many different genres as you can. And anybody who wants to be a writer and isn't thrilled to get that assignment probably shouldn't be a writer. So read. And then make some deal with yourself about how you're going to do the work. For me, it's that 2 pages a day thing that works. It won't be the same for everybody. That's the thing that I have found that will get me through it. But figure out what works and then kind of commit to it and stick to it. And there are a lot of kids now who write, and they will say to me sometimes, I get halfway through and then I get bored. What do I do? And I think that when you're bored, it's that you're afraid. And so the thing to do is to keep going. So that's my 3rd piece of advice, persistence. Don't stop.
Excellent. And in terms of using works of literature like this to have some insight into your own life and feel better, how do you think that might work?
Well, I can only speak personally there. I mean, for me, stories act as magnifying glasses and as telescopes and as blueprints. And so what I read in a story, I absorb it, and it helps me see the world, and it helps me see myself. And I think for a lot of kids, it works that way, too. And it doesn't necessarily need to be articulated. You just take it in, and you use it to help arrange how you think about the world. So no one needs to say to somebody, now, what did you get out of this that you think would might be useful in your own life? Because we internalize the stories, and they help us see. That's what I think.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And I definitely felt better after I read Flora and Ulysses. And I encourage everyone to do the same and to check out all of Kate DiCamillo's books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hope it was a lot of fun.
Well, you can read all about Kate in the September 2014 Back to School issue of BeIncandescent.com. You are listening today to Kate DiCamillo, author of many beloved children's books, including the 2014 Newbery Medal Award winner, Flora and Ulysses. You are listening to the Incandescent Radio Network, and we look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks, Kate. That's it for today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Be sure to check back next week on the Incandescent Radio Network for another interview with a successful author who is happy to share their story. Here's to writing your heart out and keeping your dreams alive. Thanks so much for listening.